Good morning, everyone. My name is Rafael Tamayo, manager of the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We are a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture, and you are listening to Frequencies, a podcast presented by OC3. And I hope y'all are ready, because today's a good one. I'm going to let our staff introduce themselves, and then we'll get right into it.
Hey, I'm Andrea Tostin, Cultural Programs Coordinator.
Hello, I'm Iris Bechtel, Gallery Programs Coordinator.
Let's jump right in.
All right, we're so excited to welcome comedian, writer, producer, Paulos Firo. He has opened for some of my favorite headliners, such as Phoebe Robinson, Aparna Nanchurla, Sashir Zameda. Sorry, Sashir, if you ever hear this. And has also co-produced for a couple of series, including the Fib comedy series at Amphibian Stage Productions in Fort Worth with Baron Vaughn, also comedian actor, and has also written and performed in improv review groups such as Fraud City and FCC Presents. And so, yeah, let's welcome Paulos.
I feel like I used to have a little soundboard a long time ago, and I feel like if there was ever a podcast that we were recording that I could bring it back for, it was today. And
where's,
of course,
the little sound machine.
It's like packed away in a box somewhere, but yeah,
we need some applause.
Fail.
Yeah. I know.
The little, come on, okay. Yeah, do your sound. Yeah.
It's weird when you hear those things back to you. I was like, oh yeah, we did do that.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, and I want to give a shout out to Kathleen Culebro for connecting us.
Yeah, 100%.
And well, what do you want to tell us about what we have coming up, our collaboration here with FTC Comedy Presents?
This is like, I mentioned this to you guys, I think, a million times, but this is like a show that my creative partner, Chris Olson, and I have been planning for like the last 10 years. So it's so cool how all of this came together. A little like backstory, and I have to, because he's no longer with us, but a buddy of mine, Clint Pacaworth, is actually who booked me for that first show I did with Baron Vaughn. We ended up exchanging numbers, and he asked me to come back later that week, and out of his pocket paid me, because at that time we didn't really have a payment structure. And then they ended up hiring me the next year, because Clint would no longer was producing it. We found out later it's because he got sick, and RIP, he passed away, unfortunately. So all of this is like kind of just like happenstance, like, you know, I got booked to do the show, did the show. The next year I came on as a producer and continued producing with them. You happened to be at one of the shows. You reached out, Andrea, that is, reached out to the staff over there, got my information. And now we are now creating the show. And it's funny, I have a picture of 10 years ago with Chris, myself, and Clint at the first show that we produced together. So it's really just come like full circle now. Now we're just like working with more important people, not at a dive bar with one of the silliest posters that you'll ever see promoting the show. We've been planning the show for 10 years, and it's we've done all the right things, met the right people. Now we're in a situation where we're going to produce what we call For the City comedy shows at the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, the Latino Cultural Center. We've also partnered up with the South Dallas Cultural Center recently, and the Oak Cliff Assembly, which is not too far from here. And we're just like adding to the roster of venues of places that we're going to try to have shows at least once a month, hopefully more throughout the year. We're closing in on sponsorship money for this as well. So it's going pretty, I'm talking too much at this point, I feel like, but yeah, that's what's happening. It's For the City Comedy. You can catch it at the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, the Latino Cultural Center, and many other places.
Nice. Well, and you started doing stand-up in 2012.
Correct, yeah.
Well, and I feel so fortunate that we have such a wonderful person that's connecting comedy community, a performer themselves, that was raised in Dallas and continues to stay in Dallas. What's keeping you in our wonderful city? I haven't pushed you away yet.
I guess the dream for most performers is, like, you know, you do your time in your city, which is very important. Like, I stress that to any comic. I'm like, do your time in your city and it'll pay off when you get somewhere else. But, and then, you know, you obviously go to New York, Los Angeles, or Chicago. Those are big comedy hubs. And I personally had it in my mind to go to New York, possibly Chicago at some point in my life. And I think it was around the pandemic, even like a little bit before the pandemic, if I'm being honest, that I started realizing that you can do stuff in this city. Like, I've performed in Colorado, Los Angeles. I've performed in other cities, other states, like multiple places. And I didn't have to move to do that, you know? So I really like what's happening in Dallas. I like the new talent that we continuously have. Like, every year there's like a new roster of people that come out. I really like putting people on their first big, important show. Again, I'm always going to have love for Amphibian Stage because of what they allowed me to foster there. And also Dallas Comedy House, which is no longer with us, but that was a hit in the pandemic as well. But they allowed me to create these shows and give people opportunities. And I love that. I love, like, when I'm like, hey, this show's going to sell out. And it's a person who's doing their first, like, sold out show where they're going to get some money afterwards. Like, that feels cool to me. Like, and this is what Chris and I have been talking about for years is, you know, when we get our show, like, we're going to make sure that we pay more than such and such and such. And, you know, and it's not like a competition. It's just like, you know, it's like, hey, I see you. I see what you're doing. I see the work that you're putting in. You want to come and do this. Hopefully you think it's a cool show. I think it's a cool show personally, and we'll pay you for it. And that's what we hope to do with, you know, For the City Comedy. And we're going to get some big headliners from around the country, around the state, around the city. And then we're going to get some up-and-comers to open up for them and, like, you know, have that experience.
I got way too excited for 11 o'clock on a Friday morning by listening to you talk about all this stuff. Because I think everything you're saying is, you know, kind of in line with what we do here at the Cultural Center. But it's interesting, like, the perspective of, I can do this in my city. Yeah. I've been to these other places. I've seen it. I've had experiences. But my city's got a lot going on, and I can do it there. And I think that's really important, too, because I think a lot of, particularly in the arts community, mm-hmm. we just had a group come by, and Iris talked about the artists in the exhibit that have their work up. And each one of those artists has had some kind of experience far away from here, mm-hmm. but they're producing here. They're exhibiting their work here. And I think you're right. So the excitement of, one, comedy shows, two, being able to have someone kind of lead those efforts with the idea of, yo, Dallas has a scene, yeah. and we're here for it.
Yeah, 100%. I feel like this is a positive podcast, so I don't want to be too negative. But Dallas is cool. Dallas has a swagger to it. You know, Dallas has a unique, like, culture to it. And I don't feel that often that's represented. When you think about Dallas, when people think about Dallas, they either, you know, either you're from the East Coast and you think we're riding on horses across, you know, yes. the highway, or, you know, you're from Houston and you think, oh, that's where the $30,000 millionaires live or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, Dallas has like an art scene, a mm-hmm. thriving art yes. scene, right? And I'm not one of those people who is just like, you know, art is comedy is art. But, you know, it is a creative, like, yes. effort, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And so why not allow our scene to not just be, and no knock on the clubs, you know, the clubs are great, and, you know, if you want to work the clubs, go have at it. Like, that is where you build muscle. But also we can have like this alternative thing. And that's what I try to provide, is the alternative thing. And it's cool that we're going to get to do very intimate spaces like the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, 300 seaters like the Latino Cultural Center. The Oak Cliff Assembly holds about 500 people and has a beautiful art space, right? These are going to be like alternative shows, one night shows, you know, that I don't know, like it is a work that you're going to see one time and then it's going to go away. And I think that's cool, right? Because otherwise, you know, it is, you are going to the club every week to see something. We're just doing something a little bit different because we have the space to do it. And I think that's cool, you know? Hopefully that wasn't too negative. I feel like I should talk in my NPR voice now.
We're here with Paola Spiro.
The time is.
So I imagined it's very difficult for some. It is difficult for me. I always feel like I have to put on a different kind of persona to speak in front of people, and I'm not trying to make anyone laugh. So what has moved you, what has inspired you to do comedy that makes you want to get up in front of people?
when I was younger, especially in school or in my group of friends, I was like the clown, you know. I would find myself in these situations where it was I was single with a group of friends that were there with their partners, and I was like, well, this is a little bit awkward, so I'm going to put on a show for everybody so that way you were not thinking about that. And then I found enough people telling me, I think every comic has the same origin story. Enough people tell you like, hey, you should go try that on stage. Mm-hmm. Luckily, my cousin, who is an MC in Dallas, he produces a show with a group called Collab. I don't know if you guys probably you've seen them in Deep Ellum somewhere, but he had done a couple of open mics and was like, hey man, if you want to get it out, that's probably the place to do it. And so I went to an open mic and I died a small death on stage. It was horrible. And I would not wish that on anybody, but I loved it. I fell in love with it like immediately. Just being on stage and getting to like kind of express myself was like a cool thing. I'm a middle child, so I was practically ignored most of my life. Yeah, Andrea is waving at me for the viewers at home. But yeah, so I was like practically ignored. So just like being able to talk without somebody interrupting me was a pretty cool thing. And then I found that over time I got like better at it, and I just like kept on going with it. I now find myself quiet. Like I should have asked you guys like what kind of stuff we could talk about.
No holds barred.
Okay.
Yeah, no holds barred.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I used to frequent this bar. And
were they served alcohol?
Yes. that's not the bad part.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I would go there, and this is like well into comedy, but this is me at any bar. I have my headphones on. I have my notebook out. You know, I'm like working on stuff. I'm, you know, whatever. And I just keep to myself. I don't talk to anybody. And it wasn't until like a couple of months into me frequenting this bar like often, that one of the bouncers there was like, man, we didn't know what to make of you when you first came in. We were just like, either this guy is really cool or he is going to shoot us all. And because he was like, I don't know. This is he taking names down? Is he writing down who he doesn't like? And I was like, oh, no, dude, I get it off on stage. So I don't need to, you know, do an act for anybody anymore because I have my place to do that now. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I think I answered your question in a roundabout way. But, yeah.
Well, that leads me to ask about the fact that you do stand up and you work with improv. Can you talk a little bit about FCC Presents and the duality of that, the stand up versus?
Myself, Julia Cotton, Jarrell, and Jade Smith. We started a group in, they're going to kill me if they hear this. I want to say it was 2016 is when before that, we noticed that we were the four black people in a mostly white space that people would always come up to us and ask us, like, hey, we want to work on this project with you. And we noticed that we never worked together. So one day we kind of just like thought about that out loud. And we were like, well, we should probably set a time to sit down and talk to each other. And we ended up going to Julia Cotton's place at the time. She made dinner for us. And we just kind of vented like all of our like frustrations of being like the token black person in like mostly white spaces. And that became a show. Like, we didn't know it was going to become, we didn't know what we wanted to do, but it became a show. And it was called The Wrong Party. And it was that feeling of you went to a party and you were like, oh, am I supposed to be here? And it's funny because Chris Olsen actually made the artwork for that one. And it was this, it's this beautiful abstract piece that I still have somewhere. Like I have hung somewhere, but it's four blue dots in a mostly white dot circle. And they're just separated. And they're kind of like, you could tell they're just like, should we be with each other? I don't know what's happening. And it went well, man. I love that. It's my favorite thing that I ever did up until that point. The jokes were so like dense, and like we were making fun of ourselves. We were making fun of the circumstance that we were in. We were making fun of like everything. Like, it had a message. It was funny. It was a little sad. We unfortunately, that was like the most, one of the most more controversial things that's ever happened to me in comedy was we had a joke. I don't know if you guys remember when we had the downtown shooter. Again, sorry to bring it down. But we had a piece in there where we don't make fun of it because we're not monsters, but we mention it. We just mention that it happened. And there happened to be a police officer in the audience that first night that we did. It was the first night of the show. And we, again, are not making fun of it. There is a piece that we did in the show. I should probably give some context here. There were like, throughout the show, there were these, what we call, blackouts. Yeah. Blackouts, where you, it's all of us in Julia's living room, basically. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about creating the show within the show. It's like a very meta joke. Right. And one of them, they're like dancing and they're like having a good time. And I walk in very serious and I'm like, guys. And then I finally am like, somebody just like shot a lot of people in downtown. And then it blacks out. Right. Mm. What the guy didn't realize was after the intermission, we come back and we talk about it. It's a very heavy conversation that we're like, should we even proceed with this show? Like, I don't. So again, it's a very meta take on what happened in real life. And the dude just stormed out. He yelled at the owner, like yelled at her. It was our debut show. Usually what they do is after you debut a review, they come in with a bottle of champagne and, you know, they congratulate you, especially, you know, if you sold out the show, which we did. And they came in with that bottle of champagne and they were like, you guys have to take that line out. And we kind of fought back a little bit. But it was either, it's either, yo, this show's important, we need to have it out there, let's just take out the line, which we did. Unfortunately, I kind of look back at that, I'm kind of upset with myself, but whatever, we took it out. But we learned a lesson that day, that like, because we're not the first people to have mentioned that, and I know that for a fact. We're not, and we're also not the first people to make a controversial joke. We were the first to be told, hey, you got to now censor yourself in a bit. So anyway, that's the history with that group. We recently were featured on the Dallas Morning News, which I thought was insane because that's not something that we were striving for. Mm-hmm. We were just like, hey, we're four black. And also we've grown since then. There's more members in the group. And with this new group of members, like, we were featured. And like, I was like talking to Julie about that. I was like, that wasn't even something that was on my radar, like hoping that they would profile us. But I guess we're the first black sketch. We actually technically are a sketch comedy group, but within the group there are people who improvise. Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. That was a very long answer to the question.
You bring up all these really important points though too, and I think it's interesting to see the power of comedy kind of prevail. Granted, working through obstacles and meeting resistance along the way. But the one fascination that I've always had with the art of comedy is that it is able to position these really sensitive topics in a way where it's like, hey, you either like this, hate this, or will entertain the idea of this conversation, but it's here and now we have to deal with it in a way where it's like, oh, I feel really strongly about this, so I'm going to avoid it or I'm going to engage in it where it's not productive. That's what I think, you know, is really productive about, you know, it being brought up in this particular kind of space.
And when you couch things through, when you couch things in comedy, in humor, it really, if people are able to get there and you know, see it for what it is, to me, it really opens up a dialogue about, it makes you think.
I mean, that's 100%. Like, we're at the end of the day, you know, outside of being a group of Black artists, like, we're goofy nerds. Like, that is 100% what we are. We just happen to realize that, oh, yeah, we can be goofy nerds, but also kind of play with some of the assumptions that people have of us, some of the fears that people have of us, you know. So we were able to, like, make this, like, our first show is one of, again, my biggest accomplishments, proudest moments. It was fun. It was the funnest, like, you know, I don't know, we wrote that show for like 4 or 5 months, something to that effect, and we would meet up, have dinner with each other. We got to know each other better because, again, we were four strangers in a place that noticed each other, but we just hadn't worked with each other. And now they're like my brothers and sisters, you know? So like that was cool. But yeah, like it was a lot of second guessing. It was like, can we say that? Should we say that? Will that, you know, how will that? And it sucks because, like, you know, you're going out there to make people laugh, you know, it's funny, but then you also have to think, like, how are they going to feel about that? Cause we knew what the audience was going to be. Like, it's downtown Deep Ellum. Like, we know the majority of the audience probably. And we're also, this is our first show, right? Since then, now we have, like a more of a Black following, which is cool. But we still have white people, Hispanic, like, all, you know, everybody. They come out to see the show. But we know what our, you know, or what our, well, we knew or we thought we knew what our core fan was going to be. But in the beginning, you don't know. It's just like, oh, it's whoever comes out to this place, which is already a little popular. It's like, all right. But yeah, it was, I don't know. I feel like I haven't answered any of you guys' questions.
It's a conversation.
Well, I mean, that makes me think about a common assignment that I've heard given to comedians, which is modern day philosophers. So that kind of how do you feel about that label? That
makes me cringe. I've never heard a comic who's been doing it for a while, because I hear a lot of guys that have been doing it for 2 weeks and then you never see them again say that. But those guys and the guys that are like, this is art, I can say whatever I'm like, yo, just stop. And, like, go away. Now, can a comic be, like, considered a modern-day philosopher? For sure. I think George Carlin was one of the best writers of our time. Like, he's one of the smartest people that you will hear on stage. And then he makes you laugh. And he also makes you think, right? So 100%. But is everybody? No. Some of us are just talking about poop. Like, it's like, like, I'm sorry, buddy. I don't care how you make that.
And we will laugh at all of those jokes.
Yeah, I will laugh at it. Yes. But if you start calling yourself a philosopher after that, I'm going to have some questions. Like, I don't know. Like,
poop philosopher.
Yeah. That's going to be the name of my album now.
Philosopher.
My God. No, I mean, but, like, you know, there's part of me that's just like, this is not serious at all. And there's a part of me that is like, okay, you know, like with that FCC show, I was like, that is like, we were funny with a message. And that's so cool. Cause that is like what I would love to do all the time. Right. But and then there's stuff that I've done with, like, Fraud City that you mentioned, for example, where it was insanely crazy. Like, the weirdest show, right? We had a white guy playing Ice-T in one of our shows. We had a lady in drag playing the commissioner. Like, it was insane that they allowed us to do this on stage, right? So, yeah, cool. Like, yeah, you can go out there and have a message, and you can also be a goofy person. But yeah, like, if somebody's sitting on a soapbox and saying, like, I am a new age philosopher, I'm just like, ugh. That's how I'm going to respond to that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to drink some water because these answers are long-winded.
It's good stuff.
Yes.
It's good stuff. Well, to take it off on a little side tangent, and then, of course, we can come back.
Sure.
But when I first heard your name, Paulos, I thought of Brazil or something like that. Mm. And I looked up your name. And it's so funny because your name means humble.
Wow. I am learning that right now in real time.
My name means manly girl. So I'll share that with you.
Okay.
But do you know the history behind your name? Or is there interesting information we can get about your ethnic background?
Sure. Yeah. I don't mind. Talking about it, I usually have to explain that because people are like, what is that? But my name was supposed to be Israel. Like, my dad wanted to name me after his brother who passed away. My father is East African, specifically from the second youngest country in Africa. It's called Eritrea or Eritrea for our Western speaking folks. But he had a brother named Israel who passed away in a civil war there, and he wanted to name me that. But my father also is deathly afraid of his father and wants to make him happy all the time. And my grandfather was like, nah, that's not a good idea. Name him Paulos. And he was like, yeah, okay, that's what we'll do then. And so that's what he named me. And my grandfather was big on naming all of his children and also the grandkids after names from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So I have an Aunt Miriam and Aunt Zion. I have Uncle Eden, you know, so or Eden is what we call him. So Paulos is specifically a Western play on Paul from the Bible, or as he's known in some part, in some versions of the Bible, Saulus. So it's just Paulos. So, but I didn't know that it meant humble. That's cool. I'm going to start. Man, actually, that's going to be the name of my second. Yeah, that's going to be the second name of my the second album that I put out is going to be called Humble. Yeah, that's cool. I did not know that. Where did you find that? And please send it to me.
I will.
Okay. I feel like I'm on Hot Takes. I'm just like, wait a minute. How did you know all this stuff?
I'm curious. So you've been, Andrea, when Andrea introduced you, she mentioned that you've been doing comedy since 2012. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to sometimes get up and speak in front of people, sometimes on the fly, not like that we would love to
this
do
morning.
That. Yeah, like this morning. Thank you, Raphael.
Sorry.
Let's talk about the art, Iris. Okay. But how do you prep yourself when you have a scheduled performance? How do you prep yourself? Do you do
I slam as much alcohol that is in my No, I'm just so when people tell me oh my god, I could never do that, I'm so nervous, I'm like, dude, I am nervous all the time. Literally every time before I have to go on stage, I have to pee like a racehorse, and then I go up on stage, I do my set, and then I'm like, oh, okay, I don't have to. That's just nerves. We all have them. They don't go away no matter how long you've been doing this. I would now I'm way better at pretending I'm super confident on stage, or whatever my version of confidence looks like. Because I'm very, my stage persona is Village Idiot. I just want that to be clear, right? But it comes with a certain confidence, right? So but I'm still nervous. I think if you go in front of a bunch of strangers and you're not making an announcement, you are saying something so that way they can react to you, mm-hmm. like, and they don't react that way to you, that is the most frightening position to be in. So, yeah, I get nervous because I'm like, are they going to like me? I don't think they're going to like me, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I, like, just remember that one thing that my dad said to me when I was a kid, which is, you're not funny. No, I'm joking. he actually said that when I was an adult. But no, he but yeah, you know, that never goes anywhere. I think I've already answered this, but like it is something that you it's something that you learn is how to project like mm-hmm. whatever that confidence is, mm-hmm. and if they buy it, then you're good. If they don't buy it, because and audiences aren't stupid, they can see through it. If you're not yeah. being like. I don't want to say being yourself because, excuse me, I'm not being myself on stage. I'm being a version of myself. Mm-hmm. So if I can like project that in a way where they can buy it, then we're good. But if they don't, like if I go up and on stage and I'm like, you know, I'm a 5-foot woman from Haiti. They're going to be like, no, you're not though. But okay, cool. But if I'm just like, Village Idiot Palos, which is a heightened version of who I really am, then yeah, they'll eat it up.
Do you know which within is, like a few minutes or so, like if when you get on stage, do you kind of know? Does it take very long to know? Like, oh shit, no, this is not working.
Yeah, no, it doesn't take very long to know. But when you know, you know. Like,
you just keep going, yeah, right?
Yeah. I did this contest last year. It's called the Funniest Comic in Dallas or something like that, and. The guy who went up before me bombed so miserably. It was epically bad. He was not from Dallas. Mm. Heard about the contest. Drove here from another city, in Texas, obviously. Got here too early. Went to a bar.
Oh no!
Met a lady. Told her I'm gonna go do this show at this comedy club. You should come out and see me. Where he proceeded to die. I'm trying to not curse because my mom might hear this. But no, he went out. And on top of just being horribly bad, he said this like very racially insensitive thing to a black woman who was sitting on in the crowd. Maybe the only black woman, we'll say, in the show that night. And so I'm going up after him. Mm-hmm. And I already am like, I'm upset because I have to go after this guy. This is a comedy contest, right? And I want to win. I can't do my set. I have to address this bombing that just happened, right? So I go out, and the first thing I do is I make eye contact with the black woman that he insulted, and I said something to the effect of, like, we're going to do something to him after this, right? And the crowd explodes. And then I just proceeded to not do my set for 2 minutes. I just talked about him. And then when I first said the thing, I knew. I was like, I have them. I can say whatever I want at this point, and I have them. Like, it's done. Like, and I was like freestyling, basically. I was what we call riffing, right? I was riffing on stage. And and I made it to the next round because I was just like, of course, yeah.
So what I was going to say something about your third album, which will sure. Village Idiot. I feel like that's a good
nice.
But so like you took something and I understand the nerves part and like, oh, are they going to be okay? Are they going to, you know, be receptive to what I'm saying? But the ability to take a calculated risk when a situation presents itself, mm-hmm. like, can you talk a little bit about that? Cause I feel like sometimes it's like, you know, even in curating an art show,
sure.
it's similar to curating the performers, because if you have someone and they bomb, it's like, dude, this whole bill is messed up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a reflection on my work now.
Yeah, so
I understand, like, are you saying explain like that riffing in the moment kind of thing?
Yeah.
So I have a buddy, his name is Tyler Sims. He's actually friends with Chris and I. I'm going to mention Chris a lot for the people listening because he is not far from us. but he's a buddy of ours. His name is Tyler Simpson. And I swear, I don't know, he's an alien. He is a freak of nature. What he would do is he would get on stage every night and in real time make up his set.
Wow.
He didn't write anything. he would in real time make up his set. A lot of people gave him so much shit for that.
Yeah.
But he ended up becoming very good at it.
Yeah.
Right. And now that's the muscle he chose to work out. Now, not to say that he isn't a brilliant writer, because he is. He writes really good comedy. But 50% of what he did on stage, he was making it up as he went. Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I am not good at that. Mm-hmm. Right. I am like the opposite of good at that. So I would test it out by doing this thing where there's a open mic called Backdoor Comedy Club. It's a clean room, meaning, well, different rooms that say they're clean are, but the idea is like you just don't curse or say anything vulgar, basically.
Okay.
And they give you 3 minutes, right? And I was like, I can't really get my joke out in 3 minutes, mm-hmm. like my set of jokes, right? So I'm going to use Backdoor as a room to riff. That's going to be my where I work out riffing. But again, I'm a coward and I can't do that. So I would have a blueprint of what the riff would look like. So it's like, okay, here's the idea. I get on stage. I tell the audience I'm not really a comic. My girlfriend is in the room and she left me. And this is my way of winning her back. And at some point I'm going to propose to her. And I would make some unfortunate woman in the audience uncomfortable, but also laugh. And I would just like pick her up. I'm just like, hey, guys, the other day, my mom, okay, guys, to be honest with you, I'm not really a comedian, but Alice, like, can we just talk, please? It's been 2 weeks. Like, can we just, and like, so as this is going on, she's like looking around like, that's not my name. and then so like, you know, people would laugh, but I had a blueprint. I didn't map it out. I didn't write out the joke, but it's like, these are the points that we're going to hit. Until like I got good enough at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It actually changed the style that how I write. Now, I don't write a whole joke. It's like, I got to talk about this. I got to talk about this. I got to talk about this. How I get there is how I get there. Yeah. Right? And then I got so good at that, that if I heard somebody say something right before I went on stage, I could, in real time, just like bullet point it in my head. So big up to Tyler Simpson, because like he made me like write different and think different and how I like went up there. Now I literally, this was actually a couple weeks ago. I work at the Dallas Museum of Art, for all of those who don't care. But I noticed that there was this couple at the open mic that I went to that I had seen earlier in the day. I was like, oh, I've seen these people. And I was like, oh, they were at my job earlier. So I had my trusty bag with me and I had my work badge in there and I took my work badge out and I put it in my pocket and I went up on stage and the first thing I said was, hey, don't I know you guys? And they were like looking behind them and I'm like, I'm not talking to, there's nobody behind you, I'm talking to you. And they're just like, no, we don't know you. And I was like, give me a moment. I put my work badge on. Yeah. And then I looked at them, I was like, hey, welcome to the Dallas Museum of Art, do you remember me now? And like that, they, it made the audience pop. And then I was just like it's so, that hurt my feelings. Like, I remember you guys, but you don't remember the guy that you talked to a couple of hours ago? And just made them feel so bad. Oh. I had to go buy them a beer afterward because I was like, hey, guys, you were great sports as I was acting like a child up there. So, it's just a muscle you work out at some point. And sometimes you're good. Sometimes it doesn't work, though.
Yeah. Well, it's a muscle, right?
Yeah.
I just picture like you in the wild, like just combing through stuff and like, oh, that one didn't work. Or
I want to say I was at a mic last week and I was trying to do the same thing and the guy just kept on interrupting me. And I thought I was handling it well, but I realized that he was winning the thing. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I lost that one. And, you know, you're getting the light, so you have to get off the stage. And I was like, man, I didn't even get to hit him with what I wanted to hit him with because he kept on, like, coming back with better lines.
Yeah.
And so my buddy recorded himself going up there and just killing this dude.
Yeah.
He killed him. And he's posted it on Facebook, and he tagged me and another guy who were defeated by this old gentleman in the front row. And he was like, this is for you. He just went up and destroyed that. Now, that's not we don't want to destroy people in the front row. It's just that if you talk, we can't pretend like we didn't hear it. You know?
Yeah. But if you're front row at a comedy show, be prepared. Yeah. Be prepared.
I love how that's become a thing. I used to work at the Dallas Con, or I was an intern there. And one of the things I had to do is I had to seat people. And when it was an empty room, so if you've ever sat people, you want to line up from front to back. So that way there's no spots, right?
Yeah.
And like people would come in for the stand-up shows and they'd be like, oh, no, I can't sit in the front. I can't sit. It's like nobody cares about you. I promise you, nobody cares about you. If you go up there and you act a fool, yes, somebody will say something to you. But if you're sitting there enjoying the show, they're not just like, hey, idiot in the front with the glasses. Like, they don't know. They're not going to do that to you. And if you are at a show like that, it's not, I did not produce it, so...
It's funny you say that because that's how you've referred to me at the front of your, one of your shows.
I mean, to be fair, you are an idiot with glasses.
That's your fourth album.
Well, that leads me to ask. I mean, some of what you're describing is different from crowd work, but how do you judge when you'll go into crowd work or when it's appropriate?
It really depends on, like, I think most comics will tell you when they get on stage, even before they get on stage, if they're seeing other comics perform, you get a central vibe of the room. Like, oh, are they fun to play with? If they are, I'm going to definitely do it. If they're not, you don't, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I was headlining the Comedy Arena in McKinney about a year or so ago, and I could tell that the audience was not having it, right? And I go up there and I'm going up last since I'm headlining, and my two buddies are opening up for me, Lauren Davis and Dante Martinez, who you could see at the Latino Cultural Center on January 19th. Anyway, but they were opening up for me and they were getting nothing, and it was like a pretty packed audience, and I was like confused by this. So I go up on stage and I'm like, okay, well, we can't do jokes up top. We're gonna have to see if they want to play for a moment, and then we can tell jokes. So this guy, I don't know what was going on at the moment. I did afterward, but at the moment I did not know what was his deal. He was like, you know, had his hands crossed, and he was like just staring intently at the stage. I said something. I have a joke where I bring up race, and he was just like upset with me. And he was like, I listen to Tupac. And I was like, cool. I like Biggie. What are we talking about? Like, I don't get what just happened right now. Right. Yeah. So I go about my set. Come to find out, one of the ladies who was at the show, who had brought the majority of the audience, we're talking about like almost 30 people. Mm. One of the ladies had just recently, in that week, lost her son. Oh. And they thought a good way to cheer her up was to take her to a stand-up comedy show.
Oh,
and
no.
I was like, why? Why would you guys do this to me? Like, So I don't know about answering your question, but crowd work could be bad. But here's how I usually gauge it. And I used to teach a stand-up comedy class, and this is what I would tell people. I'm like, what you want to do is you want to give back the room, the energy that they're giving you, right? So if they are down to play, you play, right? If they don't seem like they want to play, and I learned that lesson in a very difficult way, even after I've told people not to do what I did it anyway, and it came back to bite me. But yeah, you give them, it's the same way with heckling, right? If somebody, I don't know, there's all forms of, people think that a heckler is somebody who's just like, you're an idiot, oh, you're not funny. That's not heckling. That's not all that heckling is, excuse me. Heckling could be somebody sneezes during your set. Sometimes it's somebody laughing in a weird way, right? Where it just kind of disrupts the flow of the show. It could be somebody knocking down their drink from their table, right? Hypothetically, if somebody knocks their drink down from their table and I'm like, you idiot, like, that's, I'm not giving the audience back what they gave me, right? Yeah. That's, you're going a little overboard. So it's like, if somebody's does that, like, maybe you poke fun at it, right? Maybe you bring it up, but you don't, you know, go scorched earth on the audience. Like, so yeah, that is the same way with crowd work for me.
Speaking of like not kind of treating not, or giving someone, not returning what someone gave you. Are there any things that in the realm of comedy and stand-up that you find yourself a little more sensitive to or kind of staying away or not necessarily avoiding, but one of those where it's like, oh, that's not really like, this isn't cool?
I'm always evolving with that idea, because I remember when I first started doing comedy, I refused to talk about being black, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, I get on stage, they can see it, I don't have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Until so many comics were like, man, you got to talk about being black on stage. So I did it in my own weird way, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I am one of those people that's like, nothing is off limits. You can do everything on stage. Now, I'm not somebody who goes up and just starts dumping on marginalized groups, for instance, right? Like, the amount of, like, white 20-year-old dudes who would use stand-up as an excuse to say the N-word or to say the C-word in reference to, like, women. It's like, I was like, that's not, like, we call it being an edgelord in comedy. I'm sure you guys have heard that term before, but it's never been something that I've gone out of my way to do. Now, can I take a sensitive topic and make it my version of funny? 100%. Mm-hmm. I know that I can do that because I've done that. I'm not going out of my way to make people feel uncomfortable, because at the end of the day, my job is to make, I'm the clown, right? I'm here to make you laugh. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to say something that, you know, forget offending them, right? I'm not here to say something that's not going to make you laugh and also maybe look at your partner like, what are we listening to? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, so.
Got it.
I hope that answered.
It did. No, it did. Because I think it's important always to, I mean, I feel like sometimes I watch something and I, you know, as an audience member, I can tell where it's like, okay, dude, you've been wanting to say this and it's not funny.
Yeah.
And so other times it's like, oh, well, this is funny and it's not something that I thought would be funny, but now I'm thinking about it differently and I'm laughing.
Yeah. And that's not like, you know, for anybody listening, like, oh, you're so woke or whatever. But like, it's not only 20-year-old like white guys. Like, it's so bad in comedy sometimes where you just hear people like kind of going out of their way to like beat a dead horse. And it's like, it's just, but it didn't work before. Yeah. What makes you think of it? Here's an example. There's a comic who we shall not talk about, but he has a very good joke about the N-word. And he is a white man, or a white presenting man anyway. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it's a very good joke. I can understand if you're offended by it. I 100% get it. But on paper, just a good joke, right? Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I was like, nobody else should do it after this, because he's done it. He's done the big joke. Like, you are not going to top that. And to see people try to top it, it's just like, why? Mm. What's the point?
Yeah.
So like, I have a buddy. He lives in L.A. now. And he has one of the smartest jokes about trans women. Mm-hmm. And it's not even an offensive joke about trans people. Mm-hmm. It is just an observation that, hey, I'm jealous because I want my toes to look cute. Mm-hmm. Right, that is the punchline of the joke, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, it does not offend any, or I don't think it does, but it's so smart and well put together that like a bunch of websites like had it like as a clip to be like, this is the way you do it. I'm like, guys, stop doing trans joke. You're not gonna get better than that, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you can be better than that joke, go for it. But don't go the other way. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So like, I don't know. It's like, those are just two examples of many. But I hear like, that's my favorite thing to do in comedy is like, I'm either exploring new ideas or I'm taking your bad tropes and I'm like deconstructing. I have a joke where I'm sure you guys know the trope of black guys do it like this and white guys do it like that. Right. There's like, it's a famous, and black comics do it, white comics do it. And I just found myself thinking like, man, why are so many people still doing this 80s style joke? So I was like, okay, let's do our version of it. And mine is just very dumb. Like, it's just a very dumb joke. Yeah. Again, Village Idiot, right? Third album. You're producing that, right?
Yeah. I got you.
Yeah. But yeah, so I just do my dumb version of that. Uh-huh. And it makes the audience laugh and it makes them very uncomfortable, which is my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing. If I'm not going to make you laugh, I'm going to make you be like, can I laugh at that? Are we allowed to laugh at that one? And I'm like, yeah. power. Middle child, baby. No.
No, oh man, sorry. I feel like it was a lot. Like it's. I mean, there's so many layers to the way I think stand-up comedy is received by the masses, but also I would say that I feel like there aren't a lot of comics that kind of think the way that you do.
Oh, there are, I think, ones that think smarter than me, for sure. A lot of my ideas... Like before comedy, I thought of myself as, you know, a pretty progressive person, or I thought I was anyway. I think comedy actually kind of helped make me more progressive, if anything.
Yeah.
But that's because of the people that I was surrounded by and that I talked to. Like, I'm not lying when I say me and Chris have been planning the show for 10 years. We used to sit in a circle of comedians, and these are the conversations that we would have. And then we would talk about like producing a show, and then slowly but surely people were like, okay, that part of the conversation is boring to me. But me and Chris were like very intently talking about it. But before we would talk about that and, you know, scared everybody away, we were talking about this kind of stuff. Like if I have a show, like I don't want people that are going to be edgelords, or like if I have this show, like I want to have a diverse lineup. Like, you know, we were talking about this kind of stuff. So yeah, like a lot of these ideas are borrowed, is what I'm saying. Yeah.
I mean, and you made your version of it. I mean, what you're saying, you're very, it's this grounded but growing kind of mentality that you seem to kind of let off.
Again, Paulus means humble, right? I was just being humble. Right? These aren't really my ideas.
Oh, I love it. Well, and later on in the series, we'll have some comedians that are also visual artists. And I also, in asking you to expound a little bit about that, I'll also introduce the idea of, like, we remember when Eddie Murphy did My Girl Likes to Party All the Time with Rick James. Do you have any aspirations to sing as well?
No, not at all. Not at all. Only, I mean, if somebody would have to, like, set up a recording studio in my shower for that to happen, because that's the only place I sing.
Do you have any aspirations to practice visual arts or do different?
I have what they call clumsy fingers, so I like anything I touch. I guess can be interpreted as art, but it's definitely not anything somebody would want like to keep or hang up. So no, I do love. I am in art is one of those things. It's weird. I don't know if you guys ever have this issue, but like whenever I see like an artist's like work, or I see like somebody dance really well, I'm like so envious. I'm like, how did you learn that? Like, yeah. That's insane. How did you learn that? So I do love artists. I love the local artists that we have here in Dallas. And like this platform that you guys have given us, like we're going to use to also show off their art as well. Because again, it's something that I like, you know, I don't know a lot about art. I'm very village idiot when it comes to that. But I know that if I see it and I appreciate it, I'm like, that is cool. And I would love for those people to like have like a, you know, a platform that they can show, possibly sell their art or just share it, you know, because that's I went to me and Christine, who's our curator, we went to a couple of viewings last week that they had in South Dallas at these art galleries. And I was just like impressed and also like proud of the city. I was like, these are all local people. They didn't fly this stuff in. You know, this dude lives up the street and also works across the street from me. Like, that's insane, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I'm excited about that.
Same. Mm-hmm.
Too many questions. Too many things. You're talking about art, and I'm like, so how did you get to work at the Dallas Museum of Art?
Oh, I don't do anything. I just, to be honest.
You just have the badge.
Yeah, yeah. And they're just kind of like, I guess we'll just keep them on payroll.
Just let them hang around. Yeah.
He's just don't funny. Touch the art. Yeah. No, I don't do anything important there. I'm just in guest services. So technically don't even have to have left high school to do what my job is. Like,
but I feel like does you being there or like working there, because it's in downtown Dallas, mm-hmm. You're surrounded by work, mm-hmm. And then y'all have all kinds of guests and different events and all kinds of things that happen there. How does that inform any of your?
I think one thing that it's taught me is that people who look fancy don't know anything about art, right? Like I thought I knew little about art, and then I was like, oh, I'm like a savant compared to you. Like, I had a lady come up to me once. Oh man, I'm probably gonna get fired for this. Cool, let's do it. I had a lady come up to me once, and she was like, "Where's your Bosquet?" And I was like, "Excuse me, can you?" I was like, "I don't know who that artist is." I felt dumb. I was like, "Oh, I don't know who Bosquet is." And I was like, "Can you spell that for me?" And I was like, "You mean Basquiat? It's on the second floor." And I was like, "You probably shouldn't go look at that art if you don't know how to pronounce right. the man's name."
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe I'm being too much of a gatekeeper there, but no, that was just. Oof.
Now I just want to come to the DMA, find you, and mispronounce every artist's name, and then let you try to decipher it.
A Bosquet. I thought she was asking for a basket, but
yeah,
Bosquet.
Where's that Mondrian? That's a little too close. We have to get something more complicated.
We have a really cool exhibit right now. It's called Afro Atlantic mm-hmm. History.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Have you guys seen it?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. You were there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so big in there, right? I got lost in there one day, and I work there, and I was but yeah, some guy came up to me. He was just like, "Where's the slave one?" And I was like,
"Oh my god!"
And I was just like, over there, buddy." It's like, I don't know what to say. But yeah, art. Oof.
Dang.
Well, there's an area artist that has a piece in that exhibition. Jamie Holmes,
yeah,
had an exhibition at the Modern in Fort Worth recently, mm-hmm. and so when I think of visual artists, I feel like museums are kind of like the hitting the big time for visual artists, and there are some comparisons and disciplines with like visual art mm-hmm. and comedians. Have you talked about those similarities, like as far as like competitive versus yeah. collaborative mm-hmm. types of communities, things like that?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's a solo sport at the end of the day, right? So everybody who says they are a comedian is my competition, basically. I kind of look at it more as, in certain cases, like it's more of a collaborative deal when we're doing stuff like this, you know, or when I'm doing stuff with like FCC, right? If I'm doing stand-up, my competition is everybody else who's a stand-up comedian. And this is something I had to like kind of learn early on, was that when you get opportunities, right, that's what they are. They're opportunities. And like I've been lucky enough to work pretty much every club in the city, Dallas and Fort Worth. I've collaborated with some of the funniest people. I've got to open for some of the coolest, some of my heroes, you know, like Baron Vaughn was somebody who I admired before I worked with him, right? So like I've gotten some cool chances. Can I do all the things? No, that would be physically impossible for one, right? But the fact that I have gotten to do them, right, is cool enough for me. And to be honest with you, I personally don't like to be anchored to a specific room, and I like to kind of explore and do my own things, and which is why I like producing shows, which is why I have fun, you know, producing shows for Amphibian Stage. I've had nothing but fun. Me and Chris have been friends for over 10 years, right? And we keep in contact, but it has been so fun the last couple months just meeting up with each other and talking about this stuff. Because again, this is stuff that we sat in a living room and would just like talk for hours about, and now we're not talking about it. Well, I mean, we are, but we're doing it as well. Like, so that's, that was a very long way of answering the question.
That's great. Great answer. I can't wait to listen to it again and hear it again. No, your answers have been wonderful. I haven't felt like they're long-winded at all.
I know. I'm also like, man, I'm digesting some of the stuff that you said earlier. Mm-hmm. Not that it was long-winded, but I'm just like, you know, some of the ideas that you talk about and we mentioned, like, oh, you are a brave soul for, you know, getting up on stage as a comedian, because I think, you know, us here at the Cultural Center, there's a component to our positions and our roles that do, you know, ask for some kind of public speaking or some kind of outward facing kind of position at any given time. Like this morning, I dragged Iris and I was like, hey, talk about the art in front of a group of people, right? But it's so rocky and it feels like it can get very turbulent, but like in order for someone to commit and to have the conviction to say, yes, this is what I want to do with this, and to really train those muscles and stick with it and be successful at it. I mean, there are just all kinds of things that are really holding you back from seeing that kind of measure of success. But it's like you're doing it, you've done it, you're gonna keep on doing it. And I think that's one that it's admirable and it's really cool to see, but it's also really exciting because for a lot of us that are kind of on the outside looking in, mm-hmm. it's like we had no professional or creative or collaborative kind of relationship with this person before. Mm-hmm. And we were like, this is why our city's dope. And now it's like, what can we do to amplify this?
100%. I need you to transcribe that and send it to my mom. no, yeah. I mean, and yeah. Like, I mean, it's, I'm going to be honest. I didn't know much about the Elk Cliff Cultural Center or the Latino Cultural Center before Andrea reached out to me. And then just by doing my own research and of both of the centers and just knowing that, you know, the city itself has like this like thriving art scene. I was like, oh, this is going to be perfect. Actually, yeah. At first I was like, oh, this could be cool. But I'm like, no. Yeah. This is the show that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
And let's hit the ground running. Like, you know, we have these six shows with you guys next year, which we're super pumped about and we're already like putting together, but we've are also looking to add six other shows so that way those shows inform, you know, the shows that we have with you and vice versa, and we can create this really cool thing where we get to show off art and show off, you know, these funny people in the scene, you know, that either are not getting, you know, a lot of work from, you know, the clubs or these independent shows that are being run and that need to be like Lily Lopez is going to be on our first show in January. She is so funny, and it blows my mind that she's not getting more work in the city. It blows my mind. Like, it doesn't make sense. And I'm like, cool. All right. You guys aren't going to put her on a show. We're going to put her on this big show.
Yes.
Right. And then she's going to, people are going to want to ask you like, hey, we saw this one person. How come you don't? I mean, hopefully that's how it works, but
no, like, but I think that, I mean, that's the spirit of it, right? Because yeah, I feel like, you know, we had, our department had like a departmental meeting yesterday, and I was talking to one of my counterparts over at the Majestic, and he had mentioned something about a lot of the like live music venue closures. And I don't live too far from the Thunderbird station in Deep Ellum. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, they just closed just like that. Yeah. And so it's not necessarily, these aren't like stand-up comic venues, right? Mm-hmm. But some of these are venues that have hosted comedians before. And so it made me think about just like the industry in general. And you hear all kinds of things all over the place of like, well, you know, they never really recovered from COVID. Or, mm-hmm. you know, this really put a dent in their business model. Or their operating had to change. And it's not what it was before. And so one, I mean, I think it's scary times to ponder, but I think it's up to like the brave creatives to be like, well, cool. what does this look like? What opportunity is this being is presenting itself, and how are we going to make it work? And that's where I think, you know, I love tooting OC3's horn because I think we do really cool stuff. But I think that's where, like, the people component of, like, hey, let me check in with this person, or I was at a show and this might be a connection that we want to foster. And then we end up with stuff like this, which I feel is also like a pivotal point for what's going to happen.
I, like, no lie, like, we were here. excuse me. Sorry again. I think it was the first time I introduced you guys to Chris. We left here, and there was a moment. I don't know if you remember this, Andre, but you, like, we asked a question. And you were like, "Yeah, if you guys don't mind handling that part," and we left here, and we were like, "Oh, I think she thinks that this is work for us."
Yeah,
it's not. It's I'm hanging out with my best friend, and we're playing. That's what this is to us. Like, this is like what we've always wanted to do. Like,
yeah.
Chris has helped other comedic groups like get like big sponsorship. He's not a stand-up comic yet. We haven't got him on the stage. We will at some point. But he's hilarious. He has very good comedic senses. He shoots content for us and creates content which is hilarious, and he wants his work to be like comedy adjacent at the end of the day. I work in comedy, right? So that's the partnership.
Sounds like a good, sounds like a pretty good partnership.
That's the partnership. And like, it was just so funny to us that, cause we have this like joke that we say when we talk to anybody, they're like, they think that we're working. you're paying us to play. You understand that? Like, this is our fun time. We're literally leaving here to go shoot content, and then we're gonna have like a meeting about like some budget stuff.
Yeah.
And like to us, like that's like I get to spend the day with my buddy.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's cool. I'm glad you think of it that way.
Yeah.
Because I appreciate because it's important to not lose the fun and
We understand what the importance that this can like have.
Oh yeah, you're doing your homework. Yeah. Y'all are researching, creating content, doing everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We understand what kind of impact this could have, and like we're ready for it. Like I wish he was here because he's probably like, maybe don't mention that, but I'm going to mention it anyway. But like, we're like super ambitious, and we're thinking like, you know what, at some point, you know, in the next year or two, we're going to like host a For the City festival.
Yeah.
And we're going to hang out with all our partner venues, and we're going to see how we can set it up throughout the week where it's just like a big week.
It can happen.
Like,
Yes.
And I think it can happen soon. Like,
Yes, it can happen.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oak Cliff Cultural Center is definitely saying that it can happen. Yeah. So weird.
100%.
Already.
I'm down. Yeah.
Cool. Oh, man. Can we? We'll just be here another hour, 2 hours chatting.
Well, how can people find you and find FTC Comedy?
We have a Instagram page currently, and it is FTC, so like For the City, FTC underscore comedy, or at FTC underscore comedy, excuse me. You can find me on Instagram at Paul Says Nothing, PAUL Says Nothing. Christopher Olson is also on Instagram. He's my creative partner, and I'm actually stalling so I can look up his IG because it's just numbers. it's 40666 at 40666, and you can hit us, you can find us on those. We're always promoting the shows, talking about the shows. Sometimes we're at a bar if you want to just like pull up, and it was like you can see us like nerd out about comedy, and then one of us eventually gets kicked out of the bar. Always.
Well, as we mentioned before, the first show in the series is going to be happening at the Latino Cultural Center on Friday, January the 19th. Doors open at 7, so come on out, and then stay tuned for announcements about the upcoming shows in 2024.
Yeah, and just to mention, we have Chris Tellez from Comedy Central and Moon Tower Comedy Festival headlining. We have Dante Martinez from He has a show on Amazon Prime that I can't remember off the top of my head. And then Lily Lopez will also be there. We're also going to have a food truck outside. Pincha Smokers Barbecue, oh. Tex-Mex Barbecue.
We know them. Yeah. My mom won't let me say their name.
Because... Well, you can say it there. I promise. Your mom will not be there unless you bring her. Then, yeah. But yeah, yeah. Please come out. It's going to be a party for the city. Let's do it.
Oh, man. I'm excited. Looking forward to it. But yes, on behalf of OC3, I think we'd like to thank Paulus the Humble for joining us today. Again, you heard all the information. We got the upcoming show. Make sure you find and follow him and his crew because they got a lot of cool stuff happening in the city, and 2024 will definitely be one for the books. You have been listening to OC3 Frequencies, a podcast by the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We are a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture. Make sure you find and follow us. We're on Instagram at Oak Cliff Cultural Center. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure you rate us 5 stars. I'm not forcing you to, but 5 stars would be really cool. I think the content that we have is pretty fun, amazing, and today was actually very funny. Again, thank you to our guest, Paulus Fierro. Looking forward to For the City. Again, thank you for listening. Oak Cliff Cultural Center out.